Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we look at 1996 with members of our advisory council and ask them whether life will be greener on the other side of the new year. A portrait of upstate New York in winter where the trees crackle and the stars glisten. The kelp forest is breaking up in the ocean off California. It's the Earth calendar. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. As the year comes to a close, the Environment Show asks the members of its advisory council how they saw the past 12 months and what their expectations are for the year ahead. Our advisors are all committed to the environment, but they come with varying perspectives gained through experience in government, academia, science, business, and the media. The workings of Congress and the relations between Washington and states has generated considerable comment. By the time the 104th Congress adjourned, much of the momentum to decimate federal environmental laws had been slowed. But this moderating trend was not seen in some states. A political force which gained momentum throughout 1996 is the drive to devolve more responsibility to state governments. These diverse trends sparked reaction from two of our advisory council members, Mary Lou Reed, who has just finished 12 years as a Democratic member of the Idaho State Senate, and Joan Davidson, former Commissioner of Parks and Historic Preservation for the state of New York. State Senator Reed's reaction to the last 12 months is mixed.
Well, I think 96 itself had some lots of ups and downs because there were some very worrisome moments in which it looked like Congress was pushing the limits. I think that one of the reasons I'm more optimistic about 1997 is that I think that the Republican Congress did push those limits as far as they can go, and I think they recognize that it's politically dangerous to tamper with the national consensus. I think we definitely do have a national consensus that the environment merits protection. And so I think that the Clinton win gives us a safety protection. The threat of his veto, I hope, will make it possible for some bipartisan movement in the Congress that may make it possible to amend the Superfund law and perhaps even the Endangered Species Act without tampering with the goals. So that's my optimism. I'm certainly still, it's a mixed bag. I'm somewhat pessimistic. Certainly in the Rocky Mountain West, I'm concerned about keeping the public lands, federal public lands, public.
Joan Davidson is encouraged by public support for the environment, which mobilized in reaction to proposals in the Congress to weaken our environmental laws. She also notes that while New York State passed a massive Environmental Bond Act to support environmental projects, constant vigilance will be necessary to make sure that the New York Governor Pataki and his administration spends the funds properly.
Well, it seems to me the big story this year is how Americans all across the country, you know, once they figured out what was going on in the Congress, rose up on their hind legs and made a ruckus to save our environmental gains. And looking back, it appears to have been only a halfway victory, and it looks as though the fight will have to be made all over again in the new year. But the public has learned how to flex its muscle and make noise, and I do feel confident that we will prevail.
Mary Lou, as you think about that in Idaho, how do you react to Joan's message of hope?
I certainly agree with Joan in terms of the public did respond and Congress picked up on that. But unfortunately, I think here in the Rocky Mountain states, the environmental message still does not percolate in the same way as it does in the rest of the country. And I think that the fact that we have a completely conservative set of legislatures mm-hmm. up and down the Rocky Mountain corridor does not bode well for the issue of can the states take over the management of federal land, et cetera.
During 1996, rhetoric about turning management of federal lands over to the states increased. This causes Senator Reid concern, but she thinks the support for the wise use or individual property rights movement may have peaked. Now, Mary Lou, in your state, there seems to be this increasing pressure to have local government manage and control federal lands.
Right.
Is that going to accelerate in 97?
Well, I think so. And I do think that Senator Larry Craig will play to the crowd there, and he has a new bill that he is already floating, which basically would permit states to take over management of federal land. And last year, our legislature, with just a handful of us in opposition, passed a bill that would permit this sort of thing. I think some of the states, are getting the feeling that they can do just about everything. I mean, they can do welfare reform. They're going to be able to pick up on devolution of all dollars. And certainly out here, where that we have so many public lands, why that's about the most delicious thing that people can think of gobbling up and taking control of. Again, I am very, very hopeful that the national consensus would prevent this, and that the wise folks in New York and California would recognize that those public lands are theirs too, not just the local communities.
I think the interesting thing is going to be, when is the tide going to swing back, the pendulum, to belief in public investment in our common holdings here? It's got to happen. This state's business is going to be an immense flop.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of all the social programs you mentioned, it just ain't going to work. And people are going to mind that their lands are going to be... you think, Mary Lou? And
yeah,
the question is, when is the realization going to set in?
I have a feeling that the so-called wise use movement is actually on its... We're seeing the end of it. So we may be in the middle of the swing of the pendulum. It's just hard. It's hard to see when we're right in the middle of it, and I do think there'll be a lot of fuss about it, and perhaps that will cause a heightened awareness across the country that will hasten good sense and some understanding of the need to protect the commons.
Clearly, one of the things to watch in 1997 will be U.S. Senator Craig's effort to put more management of federal lands under the jurisdiction of the states in which they are located. This is an issue affecting every American, as federal lands are owned by all of us. Mary Lou Reid has just completed 12 years of service as a member of the Idaho State Senate, and Joan Davidson is the former Commissioner of Parks and Historic Preservation of the state of New York. They are both members of the Advisory Council to the Environment Show. The Environment Show wants to hear from you, and I'm Peter Berlin. Call us at our new toll-free number. It's 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Tell us what's on your mind. You may also want to join us for Talking Green on the air for a discussion of environmental issues. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can also reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. You can visit us anytime via the internet and hear the Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. Just click on Listen to the Environment Show. You can also check out our interactive question of the week. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places which are special to us. City streets, majestic mountains, and gentle streams. They all have charm and beauty. Garrett Baumann is an English professor in upstate New York. His most recent work appears in The Earth at Our Doorsteps, published by Sierra Club Books. Baumann likes to get outdoors when the cold weather hits. He finds comfort in the stark beauty and isolation of winter.
At midnight, with just a wedge of moon, I will walk miles in the woods. If that seems intimidating, consider that Nunday, New York, where I live, orbits the sun at more than 67,000 miles an hour, and the Milky Way rockets through untracked space at speeds we can't determine, all while we think we're well located at our lighted addresses. So when a winter itch creeps up the back of my legs, I know it's time to walk in the dark. If I wait till spring, I won't be within millions of miles of where I am now. 2 days of snow and ripping winds have dragged drifts into hollows and rippled dune patterns across the field. But tonight the wind died and the moon shines. The porch steps crack under my weight like branches splitting in an ice storm. Cold assaults my nostrils, ether cold that drains body heat. My ears know where the pores in my knitted hat are. On a night like this, I realize how cold the universe is. How few are those 100 billion nuclear candles that warm our galaxy. 20 times as many cells warm each of us. The pore between our sun and the nearest star is 25 trillion miles wide. Into that gap radiates heat from crevices of car engines run hours ago, steamy kitchens, and fluffed out owls. Simple physics. Heat moves to cold. If all life, all stars, all known fuel blazed in supernovas, would it warm space's absolute zero by even 1 degree? Maybe the fear of being absorbed by such cold keeps us indoors on winter nights. Yet most people can walk more securely in the dark than they suspect. With the moon and reflective snow, I can see the red barn across the valley. Deer, rabbit, and turkey prints show clearly. Moonlight should be cold, yet when I step from the shadows, the light feels warm, a dream of heat. The dry, fluffy snow squeaks with each step, and the flakes glitter so it feels as though I'm walking through a field of stars. Thousands sparkle underfoot. Walking in the night reminds me of an elderly woman named Eva who lived in my house when I was a child. She'd been blind for 20 years and didn't know her stockings sagged like an elephant's skin around her ankles. But she taught me to read by identifying birds from an old encyclopedia. I still recall the glossy pages, even though the years have closed over her and that lost book. "Describe it to me," she'd say, and when I did, she might say, "Ah, that's an oriole," and have me read the name. So we felt our way toward sight, each a moon for the other's midnight. The cold, cracking tree limbs sound as if they could start a split through the earth, as though the brittle air could shatter like glass. I pass the frozen pond where the bass lie on the bottom, the ice above them inching down. What would we do if the darkness and cold should really take hold?
We hear from a couple more of our advisory council members, one on the Pacific and the other on the Atlantic coast. Brewster Denny is professor emeritus at the University of Washington in Seattle and former dean of the Graduate School of Public Administration. Years ago, he was a close confidant of the late Senator Scoop Jackson. At the time, the senator was drafting and negotiating the passage of key pieces of environmental legislation, such as the National Environmental Policy Act and the Clean Water Act. Michael Robbins is the editor of Audubon Magazine and is in New York. Brewster, I'd like to start with you.
Okay.
Last year, you warned that environmental programs were in peril, and you expressed some concern about whether states could live up to the new responsibilities that you saw being delegated by the federal government. Looking back at 1996, how did it go, and what are your concerns and expectations for 1997?
The point you quoted me as saying, I think, is even more poignant this year. The devolution in general, which of course takes place particularly in the field of environment and children's and education matters, is proceeding at a horrendous pace. It seems to me that environment is stuck in an extraordinarily difficult part of that, because in two senses. One is the competition for resources with the aspects of devolution which carry with it a reduction in local taxes, which is crazy, but it's a craziness that is going on all around the country. And I think that we're going to see more and more difficulty with this competition for resources and attention. The one thing I think that is happening that may be a good thing is that there is some devolution of what you might call basic land use responsibility. Now, basic land use responsibility has always rested with the states in this country, and we've only managed to acquire significant pieces of it at the federal level, primarily because of federal lands. But I think that you're going to see a possibility that the people who want to save the environment are going to go to work more and more on their county governments, on their state governments, to try to do some of these things, and I think there will be some successes. We've been pretty good at that in this state, the state of Washington, and I hope some others will be too.
I asked both Robbins and Denny whether they thought the environment would be an issue to receive attention in the first year of President Clinton's second term.
I think that there will be some severe environmental fights over such things as endangered species, but I also think that the Clinton administration, despite a lot of backwards and forwards, got both the carrot and the stick. I think the stick was the really bad press and really bad feedback they got over the salvage rider and the effect that had on logging, and the carrot, I think, was that the administration was able to see that there were votes in taking some environmental initiatives. I'm thinking of Clinton stopping the gold mine near Yellowstone, things of that sort. It was very clear that the administration did see that there were votes and that there was public favor to be gleaned on environmental issues. Now, how that's going to work out in the future, I'm not certain, but the lesson, it seems to me, both negative and positive, is very clear.
I would agree with all of what you said. I think that the other big shift, and Peter was perfectly right in saying we both really talked about the politics of the year, as indeed you should in a presidential year. But I think that with respect to the environment, there is a piece of bad news, which is that I think while the legislative and congressional seat changes and victories and so on were, as always, a mixed bag, and they're more closely associated with other issues like taxes and funding and budgeting and so forth. I do think that with respect to the environment, we're probably seeing some entrenchment of not very good people in both places, that is both Washington and in all of the state legislatures. And I think that what I said about the movement to the states of the government in general, as it were, is kind of risky. And the fact that the Democratic Party itself is becoming more and more centrist, some days I even wonder if it's even center-right, I think that will be a problem at the legislative level with respect to these matters.
Looking forward, Mike Robbins is optimistic that campaign finance reform will get serious hearing, something he feels is important if the Congress is to manage natural resources for the public rather than private interests. Brewster Denny's optimism is limited.
I have to say I'm not very optimistic about the general American polity and nor about the sets of issues that I care most about. The one thing about optimism that I might say is that I think the environmental leaders in this country and the environmental movement has become much better and much more effective, has kind of moved itself out of being in the what you might call the tree hugger box. Mm-hmm. and I really respect the people. I realize I'm speaking to two of them as I say this, and I really respect that this has happened, and I think this is very important. We have a Secretary of Interior who's a strong and vibrant spokesman on these issues, and I think he's getting away with it, if you see what I mean. And I think that's good. Now, when it comes down to the issues, I think it's a very scary time to get anything right done, and we need a kind of a big change in this country, and above all, we need strong and vigorous presidential leadership.
Brewster Denny is Professor Emeritus at the University of Washington in Seattle, and Mike Robbins is editor of Audubon Magazine. They are both members of the Advisory Council of the Environment Show. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we broadcast, the giant kelp, a massive seaweed which grows off our western coast from California to Alaska, is breaking up. It happens every year at this time. Dr. Stephen Webster, science advisor at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California, says in many ways the kelp forest in the sea resembles tree forests on land.
Well, the kelp forest grows to be a very lush seaweed forest. The giant kelps are large brown algae that are really the trees of the forest. They grow to the surface near shore from depths as much as 80 or 100 feet. And then in the fall, we begin to get our winter storm swells coming out of the Gulf of Alaska. And those big swells coming in close to shore rip loose, probably up to 90% of the kelps and other seaweeds that have grown during the summer. So that's just beginning to happen now.
Dr. Weber says the kelp uses air sacs to keep itself upright in the water.
Kelps are large brown seaweeds. The giant kelp starts from a sort of entwined root-like holdfast system that's the size of a small garbage can attached to the rock, and then may reach 100 feet to the surface with branching 2 to 3 foot long leaf-like blades branching off a sort of a central stem or stipe as it reaches toward the surface. Those blades branch off about every foot as you move up the frond toward the surface, and at the base of each blade is a little gas-filled float about the size of your thumb. And it's those floats that keep the plant upright in the water column. These algae don't have mechanical tissue like terrestrial plants that would keep a tree upright, for instance. So they depend on these floats to keep them up, reaching toward the abundant sunlight at the surface.
Dr. Webster says some kelp is harvested and used to produce algin or algenic acid, an ingredient in many prepared foods, house paint, and rubber tires. In this day when ecotourism is the in thing, why not spend your next Christmas holiday underwater off the Pacific coast in the giant kelp forest? You can watch the giant kelp break up as the ocean is churned by the force of winter storms descending from Alaska. It's hard to sing Christmas carols down there, but an amphibious Santa can find you as the forest canopy breaks up and he won't have to slide down a chimney. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burling. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 365. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. Theme music was written and performed by Dolph Burley and David Leonard. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Foundation, and the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues. Also, Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.